Hello there. Today is Tuesday, April 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump weighs his options following a chemical attack on civilians in Syria. The president's attorney is the subject of a police raid.
We cannot allow atrocities like that.
African migrants are in limbo after Israel nixes a resettlement plan. Also ahead, a coalition to end sexual exploitation sees victories. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump is promising quick action in response to what he called a barbaric suspected chemical weapons attack in Syria and made clear Monday that all options, including military action, are on the table.
It was an atrocious attack. It was horrible. You don't see things like that, as bad as the news is around the world. You just don't see those images. We are studying that situation extremely closely. We are meeting with our military and everybody else, and we'll be making some major decisions over the next 24 to 48 hours.
The UN Security Council could vote as early as Tuesday on rival U.S. and Russian proposals to investigate. Rupert Colville is spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
It's very hard to verify exactly what's happened in Douma. These are extremely grave allegations of yet another devastating chemical attack, but it's really impossible to verify anything at this point, unfortunately.
Well, joining us now to talk about how the U.S. might respond is Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute. So what do you make of the strong statement the president made Monday?
I think the president is clear in his mind on who's responsible for this attack and what was done. The world community has already come out very clearly, condemned the Syrian government and the support of the Russians and Iranians for the Syrian government and their support of protection of the airspace and the like that allowed this chemical attack to happen. So it's pretty clear that folks have a clear sense of what happened and who did it. The Russians are saying that they don't believe this chemical attack happened, but they have been saying that about Bashar Assad for years. And we do know that chemical attacks had happened both with sarin and with chlorine, even after the prior president made his deal to get rid of the chemical weapons with the Russians, Syria. We know clearly that Assad has used chemical weapons against his people before. It seems like everybody in the West, from the French to the Americans, believe that that's what happened here again. I think the world community is prepared to take action. It looks like they will.
This comes just days after President Trump said that the U.S. was planning on pulling out of Syria. Senator John McCain referenced that, saying that this emboldened them to do this. Do you agree?
Absolutely. There's no question that when people see the U.S. is weak, they take action. In my view, the decision to not enforce our red line the last time in the prior administration led directly to the Russians being emboldened to go into Syria in a big military, which is something they had never done in decades. It emboldened them to go into Ukraine. And I think what you're seeing here again is a decision by the U.S. of withdrawing troops emboldens Assad to take more action because he doesn't think the U.S. is staying power. The president made clear he didn't want to be in Syria. He wants to be out. Assad says, great, let's test his resolve. We'll see what happens here. But I think this makes it a lot harder for the president to remove the 2,000 troops that are in Syria. And I think it makes it a lot harder for the president not to act, particularly given his prior criticism of the prior administration about its failure to act.
It also seems contradictory to the fact that he said he doesn't like to announce plans, military strategy, when he actually made the announcement that he was thinking of pulling out of Syria.
It's a very fair point. The president has been very critical of folks telegraphing their policy in Afghanistan. He was critical of President Obama for telegraphing his drawdown plan. And when he came in office, he famously said, I'm not going to tell people what I'm doing ahead of time. I'm just going to do it. This is a difference where he's saying, I intend to pull these troops out in the next few months. I think the president, when he made the statement about withdrawing troops from Syria, was sort of talking from his gut. And the president's allowed to do that. I mean, that's why we elect presidents, to make those kind of, you know, gut decisions. But it does demonstrate, you're right, a disconnect between his prior criticisms of the prior administration, his own set policy about not telegraphing what we're going to do, and now telegraphing and maybe having resulted in a bad situation in Syria that actually makes it harder for him to do what he said he wanted to do.
The Russian UN ambassador said there was no chemical weapons attack, and they warned the United States of, quote, grave repercussions if it carries out an attack against the Syrian government over these reports of a chemical weapons attack.
It's not surprising that the Russians say that Assad didn't do this. They've been saying that for the better part of 3-4 years. They also committed to get rid of all the chemical weapons in the deal with President Obama. That obviously did not happen. They also said they didn't conduct the attempted murder of Sergei Skripal in London. I think everyone knows it was them. They also said they didn't interfere in the American elections. I think everyone knows they absolutely did that. So I'm not putting a lot of stock in the words of the Russian ambassador when it comes to the question whether the Syrians conducted a chemical attack. On the issue whether there'll be a grave response, you know, look, this is a decision people are going to have to make, right? Does Russia want to get into a shooting war with the United States? Obviously not. Does the U.S. want to get in a shooting war with Russia? Obviously not. Is that a likely outcome? Probably not. Is this raising tensions? For sure. And so we'll see how it plays out.
That's Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute. And in their second discussion in 2 days about Saturday's suspected chemical attack, French President Emmanuel Macron and President Trump reiterated their desire for a firm response from the international community to these new violations of the chemical weapons ban. Joining us now for that part of the story is Paris-based journalist Catherine Fields. President Macron coming out very strong on this as well.
He has indeed, and just within a few hours after there were reports of a suspected use of chemical weapons on civilians, French Foreign Minister condemned it in the strongest terms and said that France would treat this as a war crime, as a violation of the international non-proliferation regime. And it was just after that that French President Emmanuel Macron picked up the telephone and spoke to the U.S. president. He said to him that there really did need to be a concerted international response to the use of chemical weapons. Now, what the French president is hoping is that somehow something good will come out of this UN Security Council meeting. And what they're really hoping for is that this first meeting is a chance for diplomacy. What they're saying is today there's a chance for diplomacy. If it doesn't work tomorrow, that choice will not be on the table.
I wonder what that would mean, though, because after all these years and all the brutality and the enormous loss of life and not the first time that we've seen chemical attack, what would be different now and what are the possibilities that any other nation could do?
First of all, you have to remember that this is the first major test for the French president. The last time that there was an alleged chemical weapons attack, that was in April 2017, Emmanuel Macron had still not been elected, hadn't taken office. In January of this year, when there were reports of chemical weapons being used, Emmanuel Macron said, well, if I ever get firm evidence that there was the use of chemical weapons, that would be a red line. And he said that would draw French action, even unilaterally. So he said this. He said that in January. Chemical weapons would mean a red line. Now, he can order, if he so decides, if there is the evidence, he could order French airstrikes. Certainly the French have the capacity to do that. So in lots of ways, this particular alleged chemical weapons attack in Douma could well be, if you like, the real moment when President Emmanuel Macron has to step up to the plate and has to decide, is he going to cross that red line?
Is there anything that would hold him back, and how quickly is he prepared to actually take action on this?
You did notice that as soon as President Trump talked about 24 to 48 hours having a response ready, that the French president was a little taken aback by that. And I think what that is that at the heart of all this, France is still hoping that the United Nations will come up with something. And in particular, they would really like this UN joint investigative mechanism to get back into play. That's the sort of investigation that will determine whether or not chemical weapons have been used and whether or not that could also work alongside the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. If that got up and running again, and if there was no Russian veto against that UN mechanism, then certainly I think we could see Emmanuel Macron stepping back. That certainly, he has made it pretty clear that is a red line.
All right. Well, the Syrian conflict was further complicated on Monday when an unidentified warplane struck a Syrian airbase near Homs, killing at least 14 people, including Iranian personnel. In a dramatic new development in a series of probes, the Federal Bureau of Investigation Monday raided the offices and home of President Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. U.S. prosecutors conducted the search that was partly a referral by the Office of Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who is investigating whether members of Trump's 2016 campaign colluded with Russia during the 2016 presidential election. The president had this to say at the beginning of a cabinet meeting Monday.
It's a disgraceful situation. It's a total witch hunt. I've been saying it for a long time. I've wanted to keep it down. We've given, I believe, over a million pages worth of documents to the special counsel. They continue to just go forward, and here we are talking about Syria. We're talking about a lot of serious things with the greatest fighting force ever. And I have this witch hunt constantly going on for over 12 months now.
Well, the raid could increase legal pressure on the president because it involves the records of his longtime attorney and indicates a second center of investigation in New York alongside Mueller's Washington-based probe. Cohen has been at the center of a controversy over a $130,000 payment that he has admitted to making shortly before the election in 2016 to adult film star Stormy Daniels, who has said she was paid to keep quiet about an affair with Trump. Joining us now to discuss what all this potentially means is former Central Intelligence Agency officer and current criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. What do you make of all this, especially being so close to the president himself now?
This is about as close as you're going to see. This is his personal lawyer. In many ways, this is his personal watchdog. And he has been aggressively fighting for Trump for more than a decade. So what we have here is the FBI actually digging into this investigation beyond Robert Mueller. This is actually the FBI going to a judge, getting a search warrant, basically saying, we think we're going to be able to find proof of crimes being committed by this man. And generally, they don't do this unless they don't actually trust that man to provide that information to them. So they actually go get the search warrant. They come in. They go into his business. They go into, apparently, his residence of some kind. And this is full force stuff. Is the FBI, not Mueller's team. This is the FBI. And you know they're going to go up their own chain to make sure that if they're doing this, they better have a really good reason, because they have Donald Trump sitting there with a phone in his hand getting ready to tweet about it. So they're going to be very careful about what they're doing. But even they are going out, getting the search warrant, and then executing that search warrant to actually get the information that they believe they can use to potentially prosecute Michael Cohen or somebody else.
What do you think they could be looking for?
There's a whole series of things they could be looking for. Michael Cohen, according to his own words, said he paid out of his own funds money to quiet the porn star. That may be a violation of campaign finance laws. That may be a piece of this. There's questions of Cohen's connection to Prague and the Russian investigation, but I don't think it's that, because I actually think that Mueller would have followed that one up. There are questions of tax fraud. There's investigations that were going on around the Trump Tower being built in Russia back in 2016. There was an investigation involving money laundering in Azerbaijan involving the Trump team, which Cohen was involved in, also in the Republic of Georgia, which Cohen was involved in too. So there's a whole series of questions that the FBI may be looking at. But remember, the fact that they actually go and get a search warrant tells you this isn't just a fishing expedition. They have something very specific.
The president really was slamming the raid, talking about it as a witch hunt and an attack on our country. He was asked if he's going to fire Bob Mueller, who's really has nothing to do with this specifically other than referring it to the FBI. What do you make of the president's comments, and how likely do you think it is that he could put an end to all of these investigations?
It doesn't shock me that the president is saying what he's saying. He has proven one thing since he took office. He is more than willing to pull down every organization in the country to support himself. It's what I've seen him do with justice. It's what I've seen him do with the Bureau. I've seen him do this to the independence of courts. I've seen him do this to the intelligence community. Anybody and everybody is fair game to this president. So that doesn't shock me. And yet, at the same time, the fact that you're seeing more organizations step out and move forward based upon the investigations they have and the intelligence and potentially proofs of crime that have been committed, the more they're moving forward, the more that it shows that the system is actually working.
All right. That's former CIA officer and current criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A U.S. airstrike kills the Islamic State leader in northern Afghanistan. Sierra Leone's sanctuary for trafficked chimpanzees. Foreign spies target U.S. colleges in search of secrets. And Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg is facing a grilling on Capitol Hill. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. About 40,000 Africans in Israel are facing an uncertain future as Israel resumes efforts to deport them. Robert Berger reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
African migrants have been on a roller coaster ride since last week, when the Israeli government did an about-face. First, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced that Israel had reached a compromise with the UN Refugee Agency. Under the deal, some 16,000 Africans would be sent to Western countries, while more than 20,000 would be allowed to remain in Israel. The migrants were elated, but not for long. Netanyahu abruptly canceled the agreement the next day after his right-wing coalition partners demanded that all the Africans be deported. The government rejects claims the Africans are refugees, describing them as economic migrants and infiltrators. Most of the migrants arrived in Israel from war-torn Eritrea and Sudan during the past decade. Teklit Mikhael, a 29-year-old asylum seeker from Eritrea, says he does not know where he can work legally, he does not have a permanent place to live, and he fears being deported or thrown in jail. Some Israelis blame the migrants for rising crime and poverty in South Tel Aviv and accuse them of threatening the Jewish character of the state. So the government is trying to revive a plan to send them to a third country in Africa after Uganda backed out of a deal to take them in because it could not guarantee their safety. Israeli human rights lawyer Avigdor Feldman says the government's policy is legally and morally unacceptable. He says sending people to African countries where their lives would be in danger is a violation of international law. He adds that Israel has an ethical obligation to offer the Africans asylum because Jews were refugees during the Holocaust. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. VOA. Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, over the weekend, two founders of Backpage.com and five others who work for the classified site were indicted on federal charges. The government alleges the site was a scheme to knowingly facilitate prostitution by running ads for sexual services and using foreign banks to hide revenues. The indictment said many ads published on Backpage.com depicted children who were sex trafficking victims. Well, the news came as the National Center on Sexual Exploitation was holding its annual Coalition to End Sexual Exploitation's global summit in Washington that brought together activists and people who have been victimized of sexual exploitation, pornography, sex trafficking, prostitution, or child sexual abuse. I had a chance to speak with Clay Olson, president of and founder of the organization Fight the New Drug, one of the dozens of organizations participating. So what exactly is the new drug?
The new drug is in reference to pornography, and just based on the research that we've seen come out from universities such as Cambridge and NYU and many others that are helping us understand that pornography, when it comes to the brain, is similar to other types of challenges of other types of addictions that we see within substances, and the brain reacts very similarly. So we wanted to draw attention to the fact that pornography can be, for many people, lead to compulsive patterns as well as addictions for some.
This is a three-day event with a lot of speakers, a lot of activity, Coalition to End Sexual Exploitation. What is the goal of this conference? What are people here to achieve?
I think what's so great about this conference is that it brings together people from all over the world. I think there are people from, 15 or 16 different countries represented here, people in academia, in advocacy, people in law enforcement, and people within the realm of helping and healing. It's just coming together to address all forms of sexual exploitation, from prostitution to sex trafficking to pornography, and how all of those coalesce and kind of are interwoven together and connect and fuel one another's demand, and the overall impact on society. And having honest, nuanced conversations about what that is doing, where that's leading us, and what the solutions are.
This is a two-part question to what you just said. How are they all interconnected would be the first part, and the second part would be, what are they doing to society?
Those are two very big questions mm-hmm. that require 3 days to discuss.
Right. In 10 words or less.
Well, what we're finding, not only from the research coming out of major institutions and journals, but we're also finding through this stories coming from the industry and from the survivors, that pornography, trafficking, and prostitution and other forms of exploitation are very much intertwined and connected, in that pornography fuels the demand for those things to exist. It warps the sexual templates of individuals that are consuming that material to then need more and more often a more extreme version, which lead them to many forms of kind of more deviant and violent desires that can result in some of the challenges that we face in our culture.
Would that include sex trafficking?
Absolutely.
Would that be one of the things it might lead to?
Well, sex trafficking and pornography and prostitution are very much intertwined. The definition of trafficking is commercial sex acts through force, coercion, or manipulation, and that is very much occurring and happening in both prostitution and pornography. And we heard one speaker that studies these areas say that pornography is prostitution with a camera in the room. So what this event is trying to address and understand is bringing together those that have been studying this for years, those that have been seeing it on the front lines or been victimized or survivors, and start connecting the dots between all these forms of exploitation and informing those that are, the public as well as the leaders in this space to be more informed, to be able to address it throughout, back in their communities and throughout the world.
Do you think that these issues are national issues, or do you think that this is a global problem?
Oh, there's no question. This issue goes far beyond any sort of particular region or geographic area. This is an issue that is facing really our global society. It's a public health concern. And anywhere that there is, with regard to pornography, anywhere that there's an internet, high-speed internet connection, this is going to be a challenge. And with regard to prostitution and sex trafficking, it's a challenge across the board. In our own backyards, we often dismiss it as something that is happening overseas or not in our backyard, but it is literally happening in every state and every community in this entire nation, as well as throughout the world. Yes, this is definitely a global issue, and that is manifest by those that are rallying together to seek solutions to it.
All right, that's Clay Olson, president and founder of the organization Fight the New Drug, speaking at the Global Summit Coalition to End Sexual Exploitation.
Well, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has apologized for what he calls a breach of trust regarding the exploitation of up to 87 million users' information by data mining company Cambridge Analytica. Questions have been swirling as he prepares to testify before Congress later Tuesday. But whether the hearings will bring about real change and around privacy rights remains to be seen. Trina Trin reports.
Mark Zuckerberg can admit when he's wrong.
We didn't take a broad enough view of what our responsibility is, and that was a huge mistake.
So can Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg.
Well, we made big mistakes, and we know that.
But the Facebook executives aren't taking all the blame.
The vast majority of the data that Facebook knows about you is because you chose to share it.
And those justifications may offer a preview of deliberations as Zuckerberg prepares to testify before Congress.
In the United States, a lot of what goes on online platforms, including Facebook, but also the app stores, all of this is sort of governed by self-regulation. The types of auditing, the types of actual enforcement that goes on is not super clear.
And that means tech companies pay a comparatively small price for their bad behavior.
The FTC was able to extract a fine from Google, but it was only $20 million, which I believe is about half of a day's revenue from Google. So the fines are sort of just the cost of doing business.
That business still involves sharing user data with third-party app developers. Despite the lack of transparency, Sandberg makes the social media giant's goals sound noble.
We believed in a world where people could share and experience things together, and we just weren't thinking enough about the bad use cases.
With Yulia Alieva in Washington, Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At this year's Women of Courage Awards, the U.S. Department of State recognized 10 extraordinary women who courageously fight for their beliefs. The first honoree, Roya Sadat, is a writer, director, and film producer from Afghanistan. She uses the arts to raise awareness of the brutal challenges facing women and girls. And despite threats to herself, her cast, and her crew, she served as a pioneer for women's rights and women artists in Afghanistan. Dr. Julissa Villanueva is from Honduras and is being honored for tackling pervasive violence against women, changing the face of criminal accountability through the use of scientific evidence, and facing down gang violence. Alia Khalaf Saleh is an Iraqi humanitarian volunteer working to resist sectarian and radical ideology. She is credited with rescuing 58 young Iraqi military cadets who were ambushed by ISIS back in 2014. Sister Maria Elena Berini works at a Catholic mission in the Central African Republic and is being honored for her service to counter hatred, injustice, and war-related horrors in the Central African Republic. A Kazakh lawyer and human rights defender, Amen Umarova, is being honored for improving laws to address violence against women and children. Dr. Farida Rushiti from Kosovo is being honored for decades of advocacy on behalf of civilian victims of Kosovo's war. Lamaluma Said is a former slave from Mauritania. She is now a deputy member of parliament in Mauritania's National Assembly and is being honored for her relentless activism in the fight against slavery. As the founder and coordinator of a non-governmental organization dedicated to helping widows and orphans of the Rwandan genocide, Godoliva Mukasarasi is being honored for her role in bringing women's voices to the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Sirikan Charoensiri is a lawyer and human rights defender in Thailand and is being honored for standing up for human rights. Aura Elena Farfan from Guatemala was recognized in absentia due to illness. She is being honored for enabling the prosecution of former military officers involved in extrajudicial killings. In recognizing these women, said First Lady Melania Trump, we stand for what is right. In telling their stories, we can teach young women and girls all over the world what it means to have courage and to be a hero.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.